This is Iris FM, internet radio for Scotland's social services.
Morning everyone, it's Learning Disability Week this week, and today we're here to focus on parents with learning disabilities. Today we're joined by a range of people, so welcome. We have Bianca Wood from People First Scotland, an organisation that works to support people with learning disabilities to have more choice and control.
Yeah.
And Bianca is chairperson of the People First Scotland Parents Group, a self-advocacy group that's been meeting for over 10 years now. We also have Gillian McIntyre, the author, one of the authors of the recent Irish Insight, an evidence summary about this topic. She's from Strathclyde University. Very pleased to welcome Andy Miller from the Scottish Commission for Learning Disability. Amanda Muir from Development Manager at Equal Say, an independent advocacy organisation that works with adults with learning disabilities. And last but not least, we have David Barr from Aberlour, Scotland's children's charity. So welcome. I'd like to kick off by setting the scene a little bit. So why does this matter? Well, we know from the evidence that families where one or more parents have a learning disability are overrepresented in care proceedings. It's also estimated that between 40 and 60% of parents with a learning disability have their children removed from their care. So, Bianca, why is this?
Well, it's poor attitudes of professionals who assume that we can't cope and think that we shouldn't have children, and then not enough support from the start. They don't get support right from the start, only after a crisis or waiting for us to fail, saying we can't be good parents when they never give us a choice anyway. There's no ongoing support from when they're pregnant up to children getting older. And it's never the right sort of support. It's support you would get, but not to tailor for your needs or the child's needs.
Mm-hmm.
And then not enough easy read information, letters from schools, doctors, health appointments, dentists are not an easy read, and it's too much jargon. Parents struggle, and then they feel they're failing because they haven't attended appointments and stuff. People need to be more aware of this.
Yeah, a whole raft of things.
It's difficult.
And what's that meant for families, really?
Well, they end up having their children taken off them or put on a child protection register, having to attend all the meetings and find out why they're on the register, what it's about, and why they have supposedly failed as parents when they haven't. It's just they weren't offered support to be good parents in the home. Because if you show them and tell them, they'll usually get it. Because they do have understanding of communication. And as long as the child's needs can be met and they're loved, that shouldn't be a barrier.
Yeah.
To take them away and put them in another setting. And children do understand and recognise different people coming in. Because they know who the family is and family members and friends. So they should know who professionals are and what they're doing to help the mum be a good parent. That mum will need some support, but just if they can get more, that's better.
Yeah, and the right kind.
And the right kind, because they do struggle a lot. And it also leads to a lot of fear. And sometimes mothers are scared to say they've got a learning disability. In case a doctor would say, why are you pregnant, or why do you want to have children? Because it's something women do. And they shouldn't have the fear that they can't have children or they can't be good parents. They should be able to have it without fear. Think, well, it's okay, I do need support. I must accept it, and then I can be a good mother to my child.
Yeah.
Or however many I have.
So we need to have a sense about who these parents are to be able to help them.
Yeah.
It's difficult.
Also, I was just going to say, Bianca, I think that's a really important point
about
fear. And I think what fear does is it acts as a barrier, so people are reluptant to come forward and ask for help and support.
You won't say you've got a learning disability because you're scared, in case you do say it, why the doctor who said, why are you pregnant? Why should doctors be saying things like that?
Yeah, so
Even
in this day and age, there's still a lot of negative attitudes about people with learning disabilities having a family.
Yeah.
And that's something I think that's really important. I think just going back to the research evidence that says that, you know, where these figures come from, that 40 to 60% have their children removed, a lot of the evidence suggests that that's because of neglect by omission rather than purposeful abuse.
No.
So parents with learning disability aren't deliberately abusing their children.
They just don't know.
They just maybe don't know what to do in certain situations, which kind of supports the point that Bianca's making about the need for early intervention and support at a very early stage.
But you can't get enough support. You can get a little bit of support, but it's never long term.
Yeah.
And it's only to fix the crisis. Mm-hmm. And when the crisis is over, the support's gone. And then there's no more. And if you're stuck in another situation,
you know.
And then they end up on child protection registers. And that's not your fault. And then you've got to try and get them off it and stuff, you know.
Yeah. So these figures can actually be quite damaging because they suggest that parents with learning disabilities aren't able to parent appropriately.
Or you think you're doing something right, but they're saying, well, that's not right because it's not normal.
Yeah.
You should do it differently. But you're doing what you think's right at the time, and then they end up in units and things and YPCs, which is when they're older, because you've not been able to set boundaries. But how do you set teenage boundaries, you know?
Yeah.
When they're pushing and no buttons to press.
David, you wanted to say something?
I think that experience that Bianca's talking about is one that we're very familiar with. We've seen lots of examples of it and we've heard examples of it. The good news is, and I think that's the good news of today, it's possible to do something about that.
Mm-hmm.
And Bianca also spoke about the poor attitudes of professionals. That's also about a lack of awareness and a lack of understanding. And again, what we're hearing from people is that when they see that there's an alternative way of understanding this, and they begin to have their eyes open to perhaps some of the prejudices that are around in their behaviour, the way their attitudes are affecting what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Lots of people have come to us and says we now recognise the need to do something about that. Mm-hmm. We want to see it improve. We organised a conference, helped to organise a conference at the beginning of March. There were lots of people who came to that and said, wow, look how much is happening. We could really learn from this. And our hope is that we can build on that and really encourage people to start to think about how they can consider the support needs of parents with learning disabilities.
Well, what we actually need to do is more training. And we're going to do training for health visitors and midwives because they have been overlooked. Because our health visitor now goes into a woman's home before she has the baby to check. So if we get them trained up, they can then help the mother who's disabled and pregnant getting support when she comes out of the hospital. Because we heard stories of one woman from Inverness who didn't get support and she was depressed and down and they took her baby off her, which is really hard.
Mm. Andy, you wanted to say something?
Well, just to say, pick up on what David was saying about the importance of getting the right support, because what we've seen, the evidence from evaluations of services such as Abelard's is that when good support is in place, then there are good outcomes for children. And we've seen children coming off child protection registers, children return to families, children's attendance at school improving, and all the positive indicators you'd want to see, you do in fact see when the right support's in place.
Mm-hmm. There's also stuff in the literature that talks about a good parent or a good enough parent. Could somebody explain to me what that is?
Yes, well, I want to try and avoid getting drawn into the detail of that. But one of the things that struck me when I seen this question was that none of us are either a good parent or a poor parent all of the time. There are times when we will feel comfortable in the parenting role, and there are times where we struggle, and there are lots of things which impact and affect that. And I think when we're thinking specifically about parents with a learning disability, we've got to remember how that sits within how we understand parenting generally. And all of the things we've learned about how we support all of our parents to be good parents, what we've learned here is that it's very important in making decisions about how a parent with a learning disability is coping, it's very important that all of the voices are properly heard, and very, very important that the voice of the parent is heard. And I think what our experience is that sometimes the previous experience, the previous understanding, the previous awareness of how parents with a learning disability can cope gets in the way of good decision making. So in some ways, I suppose what I'm trying to say is that as we try to understand what makes a good parent when we're working with a parent who has a learning disability, we first should make sure that we properly understand what that means. And we look at what's been written, we look at the research, we look at supported parenting, we look at the Scottish Good Practice Guidance, and we think, well, now how do we understand this? So I think it's not a straightforward question about what makes a good parent. It's about, for this family in this situation, how do we best offer this the best possible support to give them a chance to become the best parent they can be? I think I might just have avoided properly answering that question. but maybe that's enough to get started.
Okay. Amanda, you wanted to come in. I think one of the things that a lot of the parents that we work with experience is when they go through the process of being assessed, they feel that they're under perhaps a much higher degree of scrutiny than another parent might be, and that puts them under additional pressure. They often feel that because there is no clear goal, no clear line to that they need to achieve, that the goalposts shift. So they're halfway through an assessment and they've been told they're doing really, really well, and then another issue is brought up and they then feel like they're having to start again. Mm-hmm. And they feel like they become in this kind of constant treadmill of never quite being good enough and asking the question, when's this going to end? When am I going to be assessed as being good enough? And I think that can be a real problem for parents when there's no clear definition at the beginning of what it is that the expectations are of them in their parenting.
And I think every parent has experienced that feeling of not being good enough. And it's a very vulnerable time. You're intensely critical of yourself, and that's for a lot of people. That's with all the support and encouragement that they often get from round about. So when, instead of getting that support and encouragement, you feel judged and criticised from everyone round about you, it's incredibly hard to perform well as a parent, and not just to get obsessed with how well or otherwise you're doing. It's really important that if parents with learning disabilities are being assessed about whether or not they're good enough parents to continue to parent, that you don't make that judgment without putting the support in place first. If you're judging people without putting the support in place that could make the difference, then that's an awful harsh judgment.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that social workers have not had experience in working with parents with learning disabilities, and we need to get some training out there for them, because they don't understand what the problems are, and need to know it's okay to parent with support, as research shows this. As long as you can put your children's needs first, there shouldn't really be a problem. But they do need to get training for social workers, because they just don't understand too many problems. They just see the child could be at risk, remove the child, which is not always the right way. Get support in place for the parent, and then the child will be fine.
Mm-hmm. And what about early intervention? There's quite a lot in the literature about the importance of really early intervention. Sorry, I'm having trouble saying that. Including before the child is born. Would somebody like to pick up on that?
Mm. I think the earlier you put the support in, the more likely you are to get good outcomes. That's the main reason for early intervention. And the flip side of that is that if you leave putting in support until later on, until, for example, child protection concerns are being flagged up, then it's often too late, or the kind of support that then goes in can change. So for both those reasons, it's important to get the support as early as possible.
Support the woman when she's pregnant and say, right, we see here your uniforms, you've got a learning disability. What can we do to help you so you're not in life in hospital in fear of losing your child? Mm-hmm. Can we help you so that you can get the baby home and have the right support in your house, and make sure the parents don't feel judged or criticised, because sometimes they feel like that. Mm-hmm. Or make sure the support is hands-on, one-to-one, in your own home, from someone you trust. And it needs to be flexible so that they can do, when the babies get older, the different stages, that kind of stuff.
And children don't stay babies forever,
you would need checklists up on the wall, prompts and reminders, calendars, easy read information, and see whether the parent can deal with texts or phone calls, what works for them, how they work it, so they can get the baby home. Show them how to feed, how to breastfeed or bottle feed, how to make bottles up. And when you've shown them a few times, do a checklist, put it on the wall, and then they can...
That's really helpful, because my question was going to be...
If you get an A4 piece of paper and you draw a picture of how it's done and write, and laminate it and stick it on the fridge, then they can work out what they have to do and what times and how often they have to feed and understand the baby's crying. They need extra help and support. That's what it amounts to. But if they get that, they should be good parents. And they also, they need independent advocacy as a must. You've got an advocate to help you when you get there.
That's where Amanda comes in.
I was just going to go back just to say there's a couple of challenges around early intervention. And the first thing is around actually knowing who the parents are in the first place. And there are some issues in terms of actually identifying the parents. And that goes back to, I think, a lot of the points Bianca was making at the beginning when she talked about people being frightened to come forward. As a rule, we're not really clear about who the population is that we're trying to work with. Mm-hmm. So that makes, and that's all around things like how we define a learning disability in the first place. So that makes putting support in at an early stage really challenging when we're not 100% sure who the population are that we want to work with. Mm-hmm. And then kind of going to the point that Andy was making, I think the current way that the system is set up is that it's very crisis driven. So rather than being able to provide that support that Bianca's talking about, that really nice preventative low level work that will enable the family to continue to function, what happens is we wait until things reach crisis point and then that's when support is put in, but often that's not seen as being very supportive.
It's not good enough.
It's no,
not accessible
and
either.
And it usually results in the child perhaps being removed.
I can see why parents don't come forward because they're scared, and if you've got a doctor saying, why are you pregnant, you think, oh, maybe I shouldn't be, maybe I shouldn't be saying anything. And so you keep quiet and just hope that everything's okay.
Yeah.
And social workers get involved, and something like, oh.
Yeah, so
it's not good, you know.
It's not good. And I think so there's a couple of
And
things.
Your mother telling you you shouldn't be pregnant, you should have an abortion. You're like, no, not happening.
Yeah.
It's horrible, you know.
Yeah, I know.
But people, I suppose, before didn't have babies. They were put in an institution. Nowadays they're not. Parents raise them. So they're going to want to have children.
Yeah.
Because it's a woman's right. You know, women want to have. If they meet someone that can do that, then that's what they want.
Yeah. So I think that means there's a couple of things we need to get better at, and that's diverting resources to preventative work and also identifying
because
families at an earlier stage.
Also, children don't seem to be too affected by it, some of them. And they understand that the parents got a problem. That's why we had difficult upbringings. But it's okay, you had support. We turned out fine in the end, you know. And they then go on to have children, so it's not that bad, you know.
David?
I think, again, we've seen some good news on this, particularly in South Ayrshire. We've seen quite an increase in the number of people being referred pre-birth. And that's happened as a result of working closely with people over 2 or 3 years and raising awareness. And I think when people have the opportunity to see what a difference can be made when assessment and support is offered early enough, they're more likely to refer someone else again in the future. But this is an ongoing piece of work. Says 63% of the parents we work with in South Ayrshire don't have a diagnosed learning disability. So there's a whole business of helping to raise awareness about when that support might be appropriate, who the support might be offered to, and having in place the awareness and the skills from health visitors and midwives and social workers so that they understand how to go about offering that support. When all of those things are in place together, it can really make a huge difference.
Well, that's why we're going to start a training session, and we've got one next week for, is it health visitors?
Midwives.
And then we've got more in the future for health visitors, because if we get them trained up so they can maybe find it easier to spot a woman if she's got a problem and she's not telling us, so that it'll be easier for them then to help the woman get, you know, the help they need.
Yeah, I would echo that. I think that over the last 7 or 8 years we've been running an advocacy project specifically for parents with learning disabilities. When that project started, we would typically receive a referral when social work were making decisions about the permanent removal of a child from the parent's care. Now we're much more likely to receive a referral at the point of birth, just after birth. We're much more likely to receive a referral from a health visitor who's saying, this family isn't involved in child protection procedures, but we think they're struggling and we think they would benefit from some independent advocacy. So I think we have come a long way, but I think that's come because we're working quite intensively in Glasgow, and the professionals have got to know what we do and the difference that it can make. In another area, that might not be the same because there might not be the same level of support available to parents, and I think that's one of the issues that needs to be tackled next.
Okay, Andy?
So I think part of the picture is identifying when a parent or family, there's a learning need there that needs addressed. And that's where the training comes in that Bianca was talking about. The other part of the picture is that these mainstream professionals, the GPs, the midwives, the health visitors, they need to know where to signpost people to. And that begs the question, are there services to signpost people onto?
Okay.
And in some places that is the case, but in many places it's still not the case. And so there may be support from midwives and health visitors. They may be well trained to work in supporting parents with learning disabilities, but they just don't have the capacity to support them enough. And there needs to be this extra level of support, maybe from the third sector. In one or two places, social workers have been taken off crisis work so that they can do the more preventative capacity building work, and that's brilliant. There's no one way of doing this, but it is important that there are resources in place that midwives and health visitors can signpost people into for extra support.
So is it about money as well as expertise?
I'd say it's down to funding at times, because a lot of the times they don't have enough money, so they can't have a joint service working together. It's separate services, and you don't always get the services you need. Like adult services and children's services do not work together. They're separate, and then it's down to funding, or the funding's only short term, you know.
I mean, very often third sector services who are pushing this change forward alongside health and social care partnerships are subject to short-term funding, and certainly the feedback we got at our conference at the beginning of March from people was that can often get in the way of offering consistent support, that you're continuously in a cycle of looking at how you can continue funding support. Now that's also about working very closely with local authorities and health boards. But in order to achieve the change that we want, I think it's something we have to consider. How do we support this in the future, and how do we make sure that support is offered consistently?
Yeah, because you could be a parent with a learning disability in one part of the country where you see much less support than in another.
Yeah, the research shows that there are clear kind of geographical pockets where there's lots of good practice in other areas. And it might be that there's good practice there that we just aren't aware of yet, but there are certainly areas where there's a lot of really good work going on at the moment. But obviously that's not ideal if you don't live in one of those areas.
Well, before moving on to maybe where we all hope to be in 5-10 years' time and how we get there, I'm sort of quite keen to talk about, we know that children don't remain babies, and we've talked about early intervention. So what kind of support do we need to consider across a lifespan?
Yeah, I don't think it's just about what kind of support, but when that support is offered. Bianca gave a really good account of the kind of support that parents need.
Yeah.
And I think what we've heard from parents is that they need that support at different times. So after a baby is born, there's feeding, there's bathing, there's all of the things that go with getting used to having a new baby. You then might have walking and talking, and development moves on to school. And as children get older, their needs change. So we have to have an approach which is flexible enough to make sure that parents, when we get to know them, are offered support through all of those difficult, different parts of a child's life. I mean, I know that's something I can relate to as a parent myself.
Yeah.
So we've got
Absolutely.
To be able to take all of the bits we've learned works well, that Bianca described so well, and apply them when the support is most needed.
Because as they change from babies to toddlers having grandchildren, you need to make sure the home is safe and you've put everything out of reach. You've got safety gates and stuff as they're growing up, so that a different thing, because they don't stay babies, they change and everything gets different, and you've got to learn different things so that you can make sure that they're going to be out until they start school and nursery and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the whole issue of starting school, nursery and registering and getting support to do that. We have made a DVD before about starting primary school, but there's nothing about teenagers, boundaries, drugs, alcohol, or being safe on social media. We need support and help with all these things, because that's where the struggles are.
Right.
So we'd like to do something that would help parents with teenagers, because they don't have anything. Some sort of video, DVD or whatever, that helps teenager parents parent a teenager, and about schools, how you can get help with parents' evenings, because they're hard as well.
Okay.
And if they're at school, what they're doing and how they're progressing.
Yeah. So, Andy?
Can I come back to the question of money? Because I think it is about money often, but it's not always about money. If you think about schools...
Yeah.
And how parents can become more involved in schools, you could say, well, what's needed is support for the parent in the home to help them understand the letters that come home from school so that they can respond at the right time, so on. Or you could say, what the schools should be doing is producing information for all parents so that all parents can understand it easily,
mm-hmm.
rather than so that you don't need, the parents don't need their own support in the home for that
particular time.
The schools
don't, because, but now we've gone a different approach. What if the parents' first language wasn't English? You would need Easy Read for that, wouldn't you? But your children always tell you when the school wants money, Mum, they need money for this, money for that. Can you have it? It's this day, I need to take the money in.
Yeah.
And they'll hand the form to you, sign and hand the money over. So you do get that from your children. But you shouldn't have to, you should know anyway. Check the school bag. Oh, Mum, you forgot, there's a letter in my bag. It needs to be signed and money going. Mm-hmm. If you get this help so you can know when there's stuff coming, because the schools always want your money.
Righto.
Yeah. That's one thing I found. And you also have to know what equipment they need for school, the right uniform, what days they want it, you know, and sports stuff, and all these things need help.
Yeah.
So it's all about money, basically.
So we've heard about some of the things that can help and make that real difference, but we've also heard there about some of the gaps and the things that need to be done, more training, more awareness raising, this issue around money. As you're talking about, as children age and get older, there's maybe some little gaps there. What good practice have we got that could be rolled out? And what, to your mind, are the big challenges that we need to crack?
I wonder if I could say that one of the kind of key findings from the research that we carried out was around working with the family as a whole, so taking that whole family approach. Because I think too often what currently happens is we either focus on the needs of the child or the needs of the parent, and we see them very separately. We don't often look at them as a whole family, mm-hmm. and that's when problems arise, because then the family falls between the gap mm-hmm. in services. So if we look at the family as a whole and look at the support needs of each individual within that family, we're much more able to kind of provide support that will kind of allow the family to continue functioning as a unit. Rather than having that system where we're looking at the child only, so the parents' needs get neglected within that, which uh-huh. is what currently tends to happen.
Uh-huh.
So I think that whole family approach is crucial going forward. And I think there's probably a number of different ways that we might want to think about doing that, but I think that would be the key message that comes out from the research evidence.
And I think that's interesting, because maybe that just causes us to wonder about what we can do differently when dealing with child protection. And that message in child protection for parents generally has been around for a long time, the importance of a person-centred, strengths-based approach. But sometimes we still see in these situations the child protection system focusing on the needs of the children and forgetting the parents and not listening as well as perhaps they could to the kind of support that could make a huge difference to parents. We still see situations where child protection reports in relation to child protection procedures might arrive with parents on the day. There's no opportunity for someone to go over and explain what's in the report or what's being said. There's not a great chance for parents to go into meetings feeling prepared, feeling supported. This is where your advocacy becomes really important. So there are lots of things we can learn from what can make things more difficult to help us understand what we need to do to make them better.
Mm-hmm. Do you recognise that, Amanda, you're from an advocacy organisation?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that the vast majority of parents aren't given sufficient time to prepare for meetings. They're often expected to participate in meetings that can last for lengthy periods of time without much accommodation of their needs, despite requests from advocates. So, you know, parents can be sitting in meetings with 10, 12, 15, 20 people sitting around the room, and you know, that
meetings
can go on for a long period of time. And sometimes, you know, as an advocate, we can ask for reports in advance, but if they're not available, then there's really not a lot we can do about it. And of course, we need to balance the parents' views. So we might feel that the best thing to do when a thick report is put in front of a parent 10 minutes before the meeting starts is to state, actually, this meeting needs to wait half an hour. If the parent doesn't want to do that because they feel under pressure, then we need to respect their views and go with that. But parents can be in very difficult situations, and it can be difficult for them to give a good account of themselves in those circumstances. I think we do see, though, that through time, with that kind of support, parents do get better at speaking up for themselves. And I think that can make a huge difference to the whole process.
I kind of really want to finish up now by being focused on the future and being positive and ambitious for what it is that we want to achieve 5-10 years from now. What victories would we like to win? Bianca?
We had a 10-year birthday party for parents in January. And we had about 20 parents and 20 professionals came. We made a wishing line, which is like a washing line, with baby girls. And people wrote on the things they wanted for the future were more parents groups all over Scotland and a national network of parents, better funding for support, more support and ongoing support right from the start, help with homework in schools, better attitudes of professionals. Children and families and adult services should work together. And where we'd like to be in 10 years from now, more parents groups across Scotland and a national network for parents. All letters and reports should be in an easy read format. Easy read information about bringing up teenagers. And parents can get the right support from start. And support would be ongoing, so parents all across Scotland can get the support they need, not just in some pockets and small areas. It should be the whole of Scotland. Mm-hmm. And there should be a national network for parents where they can link up and meet and discuss what works for them in other areas so they can work it in this area and stuff.
It's a good vision, I think. Others?
Hopefully.
I think for me, Bianca, your point about parents being able to come together is really,
yeah,
really important.
You should.
We had a consultation event not that long ago, and the vast majority of parents that attended talked about feeling stigmatised. So when they go to other groups, they felt stigmatised, and they said one of the things that they really valued most of all was an opportunity to come together with other parents who,
yeah,
had learning difficulties and talk about their experiences with people that had,
yeah,
shared similar,
yeah,
experiences.
Yeah. Shared life.
That can be emphasised highly enough in,
yeah,
terms of the value that has for parents in terms of how they feel about themselves and their confidence about,
mm-hmm,
being part of a network, being part of a movement that's...
If you've got parents at different ages, they can give you experience, you can give them experience of what you've been through when your children grew up, how it was for them that have got babies, how it'll be and how you can make their lives different. You can change their lives so they won't have to go through what you went through.
Yeah.
And I think just to add briefly to that, parents also, as well as talking about being stigmatised, talk about being lonely and isolated. And all of those things can have a huge impact on mental health.
Yeah.
So if you can help people build up a network.
A community, really.
A, yeah, community. Yeah. And connect. And use that community,
yeah,
to connect with the local community. Because local communities are much more welcoming than sometimes we expect them to be.
Yeah.
But people need confidence to do that. They need support. They need skills. So parents groups can be a really important way of helping parents make that move into the local community, which helps them to learn how better to support everyone in the community.
Yeah, I think peer support's crucial, and I think we're increasingly recognising that for many different groups who might have been kind of excluded or marginalised, that actually coming together with people who share that same experience is really important in building up your confidence. And it's all about capacity building that then allows you to make those broader links within local communities, so I think, yeah, you're hitting
or
the nail
what
on the
they
head.
Could do is join other groups like People First, who have different groups in the local areas, and get involved in stuff there,
yeah,
and then they'll get help with other issues and things they might have,
yeah,
and meet other members and have discussions, which is like what I've done.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's really good.
Mm-hmm. Scotland has this ambition that it should become the best country in the world for children to grow up in, and so my ambition for these families is that it's the same ambition and the same reality, that it's a brilliant place for children whose parents have learning difficulties to grow up in.
Thank you. That's a nice note to end on.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We hope you have enjoyed this programme from iris.fm Internet Radio. To comment on this programme, download a transcript, find out more information about the subject, or listen to more programmes, go to iris.fm. This recording is copyright of Iris. It's released under a Creative Commons licence, which means it may be copied and reused for non-commercial purposes. Visit iris.fm for full licence details.